so you had to leave.
I just took off, you know.
This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, here at meeting in Hearing Room A. Hey, Luther.
Yes.
Thanks for fixing the doors. I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah, it makes a lot nicer.
Yeah, meeting in Hearing Room A on Wednesday, April 6th, 1977.
The meeting will come to order. The first bill we're going to hear today is 792, which we should get through very quickly. And our first witness on that is Terry Morgan. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Terry Morgan. I'm here to tell you a little bit about a housing bill, Senate Bill 792. I represent the Mobile Home Dealers Association, and I represent myself as an attorney who practices in land use and who has become aware of the problems with people obtaining housing in the state of Oregon. I'd like to take you through the testimony which has been distributed to you, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. I know you have a full docket today. I think there's little need to familiarize the committee with the need for housing planning in the state of Oregon. The housing crisis itself has become a public interest item. It's gotten in the news in many forms. Many recent surveys have shown that there seems to be an ever-increasing cost spiral for the average family. What this means is that it hits local jurisdictions particularly hard. Traditionally, the local governments have not been faced with planning for housing as a part of their land use and comprehensive planning schemes. The supply of housing has been problematic for lower-income families, but it hasn't reached so far into the middle class as it does now. And I think that the portion of the crisis and its recent origin is such that it's left many local governments without the capability of adequately planning for the housing crisis. Senate Bill 100, the LCDC legislation, authorized goals, one of which was the statewide housing goal. And that was a major step in incorporating housing planning into the traditional concepts of comprehensive planning. Goal number 10 provides that housing elements should encourage adequate numbers of housing units at price ranges and rent levels which are commensurate with the financial capabilities of Oregon households. It's the intention of Senate Bill 792 to assist in the implementation of the housing goal and to provide local governments with the kind of research capability and data which they need to adequately plan for housing. The need for a market analysis is itself an integral part of planning for housing. The LCDC guidelines on under the housing goal actually require local governments to provide data which would inventories of their households, housing units, vacancy rates, income distribution, and demand for housing units by type and cost. Section 2, subsection 1 of Senate Bill 792 would have the State Housing Division provide this information on a centralized basis. The purpose would be to save costs in the planning. Local governments, if they're asked themselves to take these inventories, could run up as much as $39,000 per jurisdiction. That's a lot of money. It can be done centralized through the State Housing Division through the data programs and computer runs that they have available to them. So subsection 1 of section 2 of Senate Bill 792 would provide the housing authority with the authority, the housing division rather, with the authority to carry out that task on a centralized basis. Subsection 2 of the bill would provide uniform criteria for buildable lands. The housing goal number 10, requires local jurisdictions to take inventories of buildable lands, and yet it does not provide a definition of what buildable lands are. As a result, you may have various interpretations of what constitutes buildable lands, We believe that what's needed is a uniform set of criteria which would assist local governments in taking these inventories. And finally, subsection 3 of section 2 would provide the kind of data which is provided in subsection 1 on an annual basis and by jurisdiction. It would measure the need for housing by types and by price ranges, and at the same time it would measure the supply of housing. Local jurisdictions would thus be able to measure shortfalls, see where they were not able to meet the needs of their community, and could, if necessary, request state assistance in meeting those needs. Again, this authority for collecting the data would be in the Housing Division. I think that's the substance of this testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee would have at this point.
Any questions? Senator Trill.
Mr. Morgan, do you know of any opposition to the bill?
I know of no opposition to the bill, as it is presently stated, Senator Trill.
Senator Turnstead?
Does this have a prior reference?
It always means yes.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if that being the case, if we might just send it on to Ways and Means, I suppose.
Well, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5
other
more witnesses. I would hope that the witnesses, if they would refrain from being repetitious. We want to get into the workman's comp bill as soon as possible, and our time is limited. We had a late start today.
Thank you.
If they'll promise not to say anything, I'll make a motion to move it up.
Well, Greg Lipton, do you want to testify after that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
There's no four votes here.
My name is Greg Lipton. I teach planning at the U of O. And however, I'm here today representing R.L. Ragus Associates, a consulting firm. And I make this brief. Basically, we support the bill. We're not going to speak to all the issues of the bill. But we would like it to be amended to allow the Housing Division, if it so chooses, to contract with consultants to do some of the work. We've been working with a computer housing market analysis routine prepared by HUD and also the Housing Division for the last 2 months, thinking that we would be providing some of these services. So we would like, if you so desire, to change, I think it's line 12, where it says the Department of Commerce, the Housing Division of the Department of Commerce shall, to change it to Commerce through either in-house staff or contracting with an outside consulting firm shall. And this would allow the Housing Division to...
Could you repeat that and go slowly?
Okay, well, it would...
Do you have a copy of the amendment?
Yes. It is line 12 and 13, line, 11 to 12. In the middle of line 11, it says, the Housing Division of the Department of Commerce, and we would like that to be followed by, through either in-house staff or contracting with an outside consultant, shall, just giving the flexibility. We weren't sure if this was necessary, but Senator Cafori mentioned that we should come before your committee and suggest this amendment, just in case.
Well, I'd like to ask Greg Smith, and maybe you have the answer, but Greg Smith here from the Housing Division. Does the Housing Division have this expertise, or would you
come up, Senator?
Yes. Well, would this be helpful to you? What is your opinion of the amendment?
Well, Senator, I think we have the ability to do that already, and I don't think the amendment is necessary. We hire consultants on a regular basis.
You do now.
So yes.
It wouldn't be necessary.
In fact, I think we even hired Mr. Raggett at one point.
Well, we weren't sure, and so we thought we'd cover our bases.
I see. They're going to do that now, so I don't think it presents a problem enough. Not need the amendment.
Right. Yeah. Senator Trump, I was just going to say, that being the case, you don't think we need the amendment, do you?
Well, I will.
I don't think you need the amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
As long as you're up here, Mr. Smith, do you want?
Senator, in light of what's been said, I think I will introduce some written testimony and let it stand.
Okay.
committee basically supporting?
The bill was not contained within the governor's budget, so I was taking a neutral position, not of advocacy, but simply telling you how, if the bill were passed, we would move forward to implement it.
Okay.
So I was acting more as a resource person rather than an advocate.
They are charged against asking for any further funds and to abide by the governor's budget.
You only have 10 seconds to get my vote.
10 seconds. Anybody want any further testimony from those that signed up? Okay. What's your name?
Burton Weiss, Lee Burton.
Okay. I see you're on the line here.
I'm sorry to do this to you. My name again is Ben Weiss from the League of Oregon Cities, and we have no formal position on this bill, but we would like to say in general we're always glad to get all the information we can, of course, from any source. We do have an objection, however, to subsection 2 of section 2, which states develop uniform criteria for the identification of buildable lands. The reason is, Karen Morgan pointed out, the LCDC has really not developed a definition for buildable lands, and we'd like to say that that is for good reason. It's simply that buildable lands is a subject that has many different criteria involved in it, and we do not feel it's appropriate for the state to develop one definition for buildable lands. For example, buildable lands definition as it evolves in a local comprehensive plan includes many factors and includes trade-offs that are made between development, agricultural lands, and also there we have the circumstances where DEQ and other federal agencies sometimes limit the amount of growth of the city. We also have the difficulties in the city passing a budget where they can develop or have the facilities to have more development. So for the state to say the following lands are buildable lands, and then in subparagraph 3 to present a report saying City X is 900 units short and not doing a good job of land use training, we feel is not reflecting all the different factors that are involved in land use planning. We think that it's very appropriate for the Housing Division, anyone else for that matter, to develop statewide market analysis, to develop, if they want to, suggested criteria for identification of buildable lands to assist cities, but we think the state will is not in defining what land should be built on.
That's the way I read it. I don't think that's mandatory. They develop them, tell you where there's buildable lands as far as the state is concerned. The Housing Division would, and do you see where it's...
The way we read it in subsection 2 is develop uniform...
criteria.
That's the key word, develop uniform criteria for the identification of buildable lands. So I think uniform is the key word there, because you're implying that all over the state, buildable lands will be one thing and meet one definition. So I guess our objection could probably be defined down to that one word, develop uniform criteria.
Greg, I'd like to ask you, do you feel that that would provide this uniform criteria as a...
come back up.
Right.
Understand that I was not an advocate of the bill, and I'm trying to work on this problem. It seems to me that this is a basically an assistance type effort in which our role is not to promulgate rules and regulations that cities must adhere to. And in that regard, if you simply excise the word uniform there and simply said develop criteria, maybe that would solve the League of Oregon Cities problem.
I move the elimination of the word uniform.
Okay. Senator Sinistad has moved that the bill be amended by eliminating
after the 10 seconds.
On line 17, to eliminate the word uniform. Is there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, as long as I'm here and as long as you've made one amendment, if there is going to be I could talk to Ways and Means about this, but if there were going to be an amendment, then it seems appropriate to make the appropriation run for the biennium rather than a single year and allow the division to work out what period of time the funds would be spent for rather than holding us to a
city. Okay, well, I think...
Good
change
that to 79?
Good change that to 79 with 72,000 for...
I'm not
I don't, maybe that's the intent.
That's
I think Roger and Liddell to, for buying him because this is usual. I will accept the amendment to.
So move.
Senator Crowe's moved that the date on line 28 be changed from June 30th, 1978 to June 30th, 1979. Are there any objections?
Can we ask?
You said the amount is proper.
Yeah. Right. After the more than the amount is sufficient for the 2 years?
I think that would be fine.
Okay. Hearing no objections, it is so ordered. Any further witnesses? Yes, Colleen King? Colleen King?
Yes. I'm Colleen King, representing the Oregon Savings and Loan League. And as the major financiers of housing in the state, we have some comments on the bill. We're cognizant of the need to strengthen the LCDC housing goal. And we know that in order to protect Oregon's housing supply, it's important that the housing goal have equality with the other LCDC goals, specifically the agricultural and farming school. A data bank, as proposed in 792, could give the housing goal the strength it needs for its realization. The concept of a centralized data bank, which would predict housing in specific areas and for specific income levels, would certainly be a boon to home builders and land conservation. But we have some concerns about the reliability of any data which purports to project housing needs. Projections of populations, household size, vacancy rates, income distributions are merely projections and are subject to numerous fluctuations. Fluctuations resulting from factors which can be predictable but unexpected, like a plant closure in Washington would cause numerous people to move here, and this summer with the drought, many people may be moving out of the state, therefore causing the vacancy rate to go up.
All the aluminum plants closing in Oregon.
Right. Okay, you do have some advance notice of these things, but it's not a factor that you can incorporate into a data bank as this bill would like to see. Realizing the unpredictability of these housing needs, we question the value of these studies. And we wonder if this has been utilized elsewhere and whether or not, just how credible this information will be. And if this is an experiment in trying to decide if we can forecast housing and predict what the housing need will be, we think that the bill should be labeled as such, that this is an experiment, it's a test run, and that we look at it as this and not set it in the statutes. So I think when you look at the amount of money that's been it's asked to cover this bill, it's $72,000 is not really very much. It's enough to do some initial studies, but not really enough to carry out the program. And I suspect that they'll be back again asking for more money on the program. But I think before you commit yourself to this type of a program, I think that you should see what is the cost benefit of the state getting involved in a housing data bank. So that's our feeling before. We'd like to have that on the record, just so you, before the state commits himself to this program. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions? I'd like Greg Smith again, if you could answer that, you're here.
Mr. Chairman, with me is John Peters, who is our economist. John has developed a computerized housing market analysis program, which we have not been able to employ very heavily, but the question about whether market analyses are of assistance, I think, has been adequately answered by the fact that we were able to do a few before we got into our housing finance efforts. Our perhaps most notable effort was in the Corvallis area when Corvallis was going through its comprehensive planning development stage. And one of the problems there that I recall was that there were different elements of the community that had different feelings about what it was they needed and what they might feel they needed for their community in terms of housing, industrial development, and so on. But there was no good information, no solid data. And it was on the basis of the study that John did that the different sides were finally able to start talking facts and figures. And I think this had a moderating influence upon the nature of the discussions around the development of a comprehensive plan when people finally could start talking about facts and figures rather than each side's gut-level feeling about what the shape of the future might be. I would like to basically turn that question over to John, though, as a professional economist, and have him answer your question.
John?
Yes. The program that we use has basically been developed by HUD over a period of approximately 10 years, and I simply converted it for our own uses here. And as Greg said, it is available. We have used it. There are limitations in all sorts of projections, projection methods, and I wouldn't be one to say that that after you make a projection, there are changes that can take place that you wouldn't foresee. But there are some long-term trends that can be identified. There are some reasonable projection methods that can be employed. And my belief is that after you've gone through that process, you know more than you know when you just wet your finger and stick it in the wind and wonder what's going to happen to an area.
Or wait till a factory closes or wait till one opens.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And normally the projection period is a two-year projection period. And of course, as soon as you get the projection done, if there's been a major change in the economy of the area, like if we'd done the analysis of Corvallis before we heard about Hewlett-Packard, then you'd have to come back and redo it. But in most parts of Oregon, the economic development and economic growth has been fairly constant, and I believe that. That good numbers could be developed to help communities do some good planning.
Any questions? If not, thank you, and thank you, Kelly. Does Dave Burrow, do you want to comment on this? Or that's your position, though?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any further witnesses? If not... Yes, I'm sorry. Would you give your name for that?
My name is John Schunkweiler. I'm an attorney, and I'm a member in representing the Land Development and Housing Resources Corporation. And I'll say this very briefly. It's a point that hasn't been raised about this, is the value of using this kind of information. This is a housing element, statewide housing element of 1973 put out by the Housing Division. They've already exercised their expertise in this matter, but this data is at least 4 years old, almost 5 years old. We really need a updated, current, competent analytical study that goes along with this that can show us the changes. Craig is back in the same period, did a study, but it was based on the same material in 73. And to illustrate what is going on in the housing area now, this is a 1976 spring study by Craig. It's called the Craig Regional Housing Workshop Study. It's a summary report. There is no reference to data. There is no reference in here about any surveys, inventories, or anything. All that they're doing at Craig right now is putting down testimony of what people think the problem is. And I have to concur with Mr. Smith wholeheartedly that when it really gets down to the nitty-gritty, we have to have some sort of base to work with, or we'll never be able to start discussions on what kind of ways we can solve our housing problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schunkweiler. Okay, no further witnesses. Senator Trow?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 792 to Ways and Means as amended.
Senator Trow moves Senate Bill 792 with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means as amended. Are you ready for the question? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Jernstad?
No.
Senator Roberts?
Aye.
Pardon me?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Senator Jernstad, will you carry the bill?
No. No.
I don't hear very well. Okay. Let's go to the scripture. 10:48.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. 10:48.
10:25.
Can we get through 10:25, Dave, in a hurry?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let's do that. And there's Dave Barrows, Tom Paulus, Dell Ellis, and Dean Boyce. Why don't you all come up for the first time?
Wow.
This is a nice little bill in the public interest. All we do is increase the usury, put the usury up to 15%.
Just on residential.
Just the homeowners, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Barrows, president of the Oregon Savings and Loan League. With me on the far end is Mr. Tom Paulus, senior vice president for lending for American Federal Savings and Loan. Next to him is Mr. Dean Boyce, vice president manager of the real estate loan division of the First National Bank. And next to me is Mr. Dell Ellis, president of AmFac Mortgage, a mortgage banking company in Portland. If we may, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to each make a very brief statement indicating our feelings about various aspects of the bill, and then perhaps at that time answer questions if that's agreeable with you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Mr. Paulus to lead off.
Senator Groner, members of the committee, the Oregon Savings and Loan League supports Senate Bill 1025 because of the primary importance of raising the maximum interest rate for all residential loans to 15%. And I know that you're going to be belabored with this again, but to refresh your memory, the most current market swing which affected the ability of the individual to purchase a home was in the 73-74 period, at which time money became exceedingly tight throughout the country. And it became rather obvious in those states which had higher usury limits, people were able to still continue buying homes, whereas in those areas and states which had lower limits, it was generally true that they were unable to secure any funding. And so it is our feeling that we would be in better position within this state to raise the limit, since the true market forces are the thing that really indicate the interest rate levels. And I think you can see that at the present time around the country. There are adjacent states to the state of Oregon which have no limits, and you will note that their interest rates are no higher. As a matter of fact, in California, they have been until the last several weeks lower than they have been in the state of Oregon. So the argument that they would automatically go to the new ceiling has not historically held water. And as a matter of fact, since the 20s, the usury laws have been ineffectual generally simply because they've been higher than the market rates for long-term mortgage financing. And so for that reason, we of the Oregon League would support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Ellis, I appreciate your point, and I carried the bill. Mr. Paulus, I'm sorry. I carried the bill in 1973, the one that that allowed, we considered a sophisticated borrow $50,000 over, and the lid was off, and it was fine. But it concerns me when you take a homeowner, and I think with any of you four, I mean, even though the rate was up to 15%, the institutions you represent wouldn't increase the interest rate. But I'm afraid there's a few unscrupulous mortgage bankers that would. You know, and that's what concerns me. And I know, I just had a recent experience where my son just bought a $30,500 home and they wanted 9.75%. and he was able to get a much lower loan, and the man that he was dealing with knew he could. And yet he tried to force this 9.75% loan on him. And this is what bothers me. And I think if everybody was honest in the, and tried to treat the public fairly that's in the in this type of business, it would be fine. But it really concerns me.
Well, I appreciate that concern. I certainly, and we all know of excesses in rates, as you do in most anything in the marketplace. However, with the current disclosure regulations, Regulation X, which was implemented June of last, 75, it's becoming increasingly difficult for an individual to really be totally uninformed, particularly when in this day and age, everyone advertises the best product available. And so what I'm looking at and what we in the Oregon League have the opinion that by and large, it would be more beneficial for more people within the state of Oregon to have a higher limit than not to. And that I think that the new controls have been implemented on a federal level, which affect us. Do a great deal to limit the ability of individuals to unscrupulously charge more than the market rate, because the average individual has the ability to go out and find out what the rate is.
The average, so many times that the average individual doesn't know, and I've seen it when the auto in auto financing, the present law 8, 10, and 12. Prior to that, I've seen the finance charges go up as high as 75%, and they'd sign the paper. 75% discount, which is almost equivalent to 150% simple interest, and a financial institution did that. One of the prominent financial institutions in the state allowed that paper to go through. The dealer made most of the money on it, but it's still, they allowed it to go through. And this is what I'm afraid of. This is my only concern, and I'm not saying that that the people you represent would act in that in manner, but I'm fearful of those that may, would be my concern anyhow.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Ellis, from the Mortgage Bankers, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of committee, the Mortgage Bankers Association supports Senate Bill 1025. The increasing the maximum interest rates for residential loans will afford Oregon residents the opportunity for home financing in times when interest rates are on a high national basis. Interest rates will not rise with the raising of the ceiling, since the competitive market conditions will determine the interest rate. At the present time, the rates in Oregon are 8 to 8.5% for a conventional residential loan, and these are well, at the present time, well below the ceiling of 10%. The rates in the adjacent states are either similar to Oregon's or below, and in many cases they have no usury limitations or limitations that are higher than Oregon's. Maximum limitations imposed by regulation can have a serious effect on the availability of money from the secondary market in times of tight money supply and corresponding high interest rates. The example, the best example I think we can remember, is 1974, when the bank prime rates rose to around 12% and there was a serious shortage of interim and construction financing. At the same time, the yields on conventional residential loans rose to almost a yield of 11% on a national basis. Thus, the home buyers in Oregon were denied the access to these funds if they wanted to build a home at that rate. I think the future of the construction and permanent financing of residential loans would be well served by raising the maximum rate. One further comment I might make, and I'm sure you'll hear this, is that will people pay more than 10% to finance a house? The answer is yes. It happened in 1974. Nationally, it didn't happen in Oregon, but it happened nationally because these people believe that inflation overcomes the high interest rate they're presently paying, and they believe that the inflation cost will raise the price of the house they're willing to finance, and saying that appreciation will correct this. Again, when a person does finance at a rate in excess of 10%, if that's what happens on a national basis, he's available to refinance at any time the market rates change. And I think this is happening in the industry today. Certainly in the mortgage banking industry, we're faced with all-time record payoffs because the people who financed at the high rates in 1974 at the present time find the rates more desirable, so they're looking for refinancing. This will happen again in the future. And I think we must be concerned about the availability of money in Oregon when rates do come up again. Obviously, the access to the federal or to the national market is an advantage to the home buyers, and it will not be there if the rates again rise to 11%.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Grove?
Why not raise them 12%? Why 15?
Senator, I hate to pick a figure out. Let's say 15% is the figure picked out. You'll find around the country, you'll look at, well, let's take some close examples. Colorado has no limit. California has no limit. Utah has 18. Washington has 12. I hate to pick a figure out and say this is what it should be. I did not draft the bill.
Could I respond, Mr. Chairman?
Sure, but I just wonder if they want the same type of legislation they have in Washington, at 12% on everything. Limitation, I believe, is...
Senator, I believe Washington does have, it's a different than Oregon, but they, for anything over a specified amount, there's no limit in Washington also. On commercial financing, there is no limit.
On commercial financing.
Right. He's talking about revolving and everything. Yeah.
Okay.
I would just say, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Trowe, we did pick the figure 15%, Mr. Chairman, and I guess the theory was that what we're trying to say to the committee is that the ceiling is really meaningless in the residential financing area unless we bump into it, and then it becomes very meaningful to people who can't get residential financing. And the other thought, I guess, was that... 20 years from now, 30 years from now, whatever it is, if 12% becomes an unreasonable figure as a ceiling, then we don't have to come back to the legislature and go through it again. But certainly, we're not slavishly bound to 15%, and if 12% were the desire of the committee, we would certainly see that as tremendous relief from what could be a problem a few years down the road, at 10%.
One point that's very important that Dave did mention, and we need to reemphasize it, and is the marketplace determines the rate. We don't determine the rate. The marketplace determines it, and if the limit is 10%, that doesn't mean the loans are at 10%. They aren't now. But when the national market goes above 10, the home buyers in Oregon need the opportunity to finance if they wish to finance.
You say the top rate in Oregon here now is 8.75, though. Is that?
I say the average it will range between 8.5 to 8.75 for a conventional 80% conventional loan today. Is that? And Tom, of course,
that's correct. Mm-hmm.
They want 9.75 from a 21-year-old kid, my son.
Well, Senator, there's different things of underwriting and how you underwrite a loan, and whether it's a 90% or a 95% loan or certain things. And
I just wonder, maybe he's right because my name is Groner.
Maybe they didn't recognize it, Senator.
There are many reasons why the rates vary, however, from one property to another. And, of course, I'm not saying that 9.75 was equitable. I don't know the property. I'd have to see it. But conventional loans today on an 80% basis, state of Oregon, are running at 8.75, trending slightly under that. I would say perhaps to 8.625, that's the area. In California, they've moved from 8.5 to approximately 9 today conventionally, and it's a market situation. It's just moved. Now, California dropped a full point in about 30 days just this last year. So I think it was demands in the marketplace that created the problem.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Just a minute. Senator Wyatt had a question.
I'm sorry.
The last speaker before, Mr. Barrows, I forgot your name.
Ellis.
Ellis. You just said that the marketplace determined the interest rate. Wouldn't Oregon, isn't part of what determines the interest rate the availability of money, which is established by the Federal Reserve Board?
Well, the availability of money is certainly affected by decisions of the Federal Reserve Board, but does not determine what the availability of money is within the state or any other state, and it's a...
Well, let me ask the question more generally. Isn't various governmental actions one of the things that very directly affects the availability of money?
Yes, as a general statement, that's very correct. Such as when the Treasury goes
so
to
a free market. We have a free market in a way, but in a way, it's very controlled by the government.
In a way, yes, I'd have to agree, and I'm sure Mr. Paulus would like to make a comment. Certainly, when the Treasury Department goes to the marketplace and pulls out what they call disintermediation, takes all the funds out of the savings and loans, the interest rates are going to rise. There's only so much funds available for various types of investing in the country, and as it shifts from one marketplace to another, it determines the tightness of money for the real estate market and the price that it will go at.
And Oregon is one part of the marketplace, is it not?
That is correct.
So the interest rate that we set, the lid that we set in this state, has some, would be one of the smaller factors, but it would be one factor in the setting of the interest rate.
It would be a small factor, Senator, but I would like to make one comment about this. Oregon is what would be determined in the real estate industry as a capital poor state. It does not have enough money within the state and the financial institutions within the state to support its own growth. Therefore, it must rely upon money from outside the state to come in to support the growth of the state, similar to California. So the out-of-state lenders, as they look to put their funds, and if the rates continue to rise, would put their funds where they can meet the marketplace. In other words, if the national rate yield curve is at 11%, they would look to places where they can put their money out and realize that type of a yield.
They wouldn't bring much money into Oregon
at 10% or
when they could get 11 in California.
Yes, if the national average was 11, they would go where they could get 11 rather than bringing in at 10.
Correct. So another question, if this were to become law tomorrow at 15%, would a person, private party who had some money and wanted a loan, say Senator Groner's son didn't have a very good credit rating for some reason because he was young.
He has a good credit rating.
That's it. All right.
He has more money in the bank than
forget,
I have.
Forget your son then. My son didn't have a very good credit rating. He wanted to buy a house. If there were somebody in Hood River who was willing to loan him money at 15%, could he not borrow money at 15%?
Well, yes, he could, I suppose. Again, it's and the marketplace determines this. Tomorrow, if we change the law, the rates would not change tomorrow. But
you mean in the traditional
marketplaces? Right. But if he wanted to go,
the people who are providing money privately,
if
and loan money through the Oregonian
correct. 15%. If this person could not find the normal channels of money and still wanted to borrow the money, he would then be able to go to somebody.
So there would be 15% loans rather quickly if this bill became law. Would that be
if there were people that wanted to buy money at 15%, Senator? I think that's true.
Is there any question in your mind about whether there are people who would borrow money at 15%?
I guess if they couldn't get it anywhere else, they probably would. I guess that's
one
of the
expert in loaning of money, and you know how people behave. And
I guess that's one of the things that bothers us, Senator, is that in effect what the state of Oregon is saying to borrowers is, we don't care if you want to borrow the money at 15% or 12% or 11%, if that's the rate nationally. We don't care. We're going to interpose as the government, the body politic, we're going to interpose our judgment and say it's stupid of you to borrow money at a rate higher than 10%. And even if you want to, we're not going to let you. And we think that sort of offends our sense of an individual's right to make his own determination of what he wants to pay for his funds.
Chairman.
Senator Roberts.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to tell from your testimony then is why you're not in here saying just take off any ceiling at all. If you basically, what you're really basically saying is that you don't want a ceiling that is going to actually stop at any point the borrowing of money.
That would be the choice. Just to make sure there's an orderly flow of funds into the state available in periods of tight money and high price money.
Why have an interest rate ceiling at all?
Well, some states do not. That is a possibility.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
what I'm
saying is essentially, if what you're really saying is, we don't, you know, this is a bad policy, because it restricts the flow of money into Oregon because of competition with other states, then and other areas for the investor for the money to flow to, then why are you supporting changing the interest rate to 15% if instead of saying, hey, you know, we shouldn't have this at all? And
as a second part of that, is that essentially what we're doing if we change 15% in your estimation?
Well, first may I say that we're not talking about interest rates, Senator Roberts. We're talking about usury ceiling.
Okay, usury ceiling.
I want to make sure we're not, everybody doesn't think we're going to run right up to 15, because we're not, obviously, because the marketplace dictates. I would guess, given our choice, if we could write the law any way we want, we would prefer to go the California route, which is no ceiling, and let the marketplace completely control. Frankly, we felt that this approach might be more palatable to the members of the legislature, where we're just changing the dollar, a number from 10% to 15% for this specialized kind of loan, rather than just coming in and saying, we're excluded. We thought that might be less acceptable to the members of the legislature. But certainly if the members of the legislature felt that if we're going to do it, let's do it honestly and up front and out front, we would prefer to see this the ceiling removed on residential loans, as they have in a number of other states, as Mr. Ellis indicated.
Mr. Chairman, one more question along the same line.
Senator Roberts.
Well then, but basically, what is going to be the difference in the effect over the next, in your estimation, over the next few years, between the difference between this approach and taking having no ceiling?
Absolutely none. There will be no difference.
Thank you.
Okay, just another question, and I'm going to give you a supposition. Suppose we pass this bill 15%, and the rate goes up to 15%, and any member of this committee is paying 15% rate on the purchase of a dwelling. The rate goes down, say, to 8 or 9. He wants to refinance his home. Would you be willing to have an amendment to this bill which would require that he pays no penalty in event of prepayment of the contract, prepayment of the mortgage, that there would be no penalty in event of prepayment of the contract, as there is now, which is quite substantial?
Senator, many institutions have different prepayment privileges and different methods of penalty. I think certainly from the national market, which the one I can speak to the best is the national secondary market. The institution investors, whether they are pension funds, life insurance companies, or Eastern savings institutions, obtain their funds from a variety of sources, and the cost at which they obtain their funds set their policies. And I think from a national standpoint, it would destroy the marketability of Oregon loans if you tried to legislate that, because it's a policy. Again, they would put their funds where they find that the funds can be put out in accordance with their policies, not by certain regulations. And it would destroy the marketability of Oregon loans to try to statutorily impose that provision.
Senator, if I might just add, there is a continuing effort within the mortgage lending industry from all walks of life to go to standard documents where the note and the deed of trust are identical. They are accepted by the Federal National Mortgage Association, by the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, and the participants in the secondary market, these Eastern savings associations and life insurance companies and so on, rely on that predictability of documentation, which is identical regardless of the institution they may buy the loan from. And so it would indeed have an effect on the marketability of prime Oregon loans in the secondary market. And each of those documents do have certain provisions for prepayment.
Do you have any further testimony that you will?
I have for us, if I may, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dean H. Boies, and I am Vice President and Manager of the Real Estate Loan Division of the First National Bank of Oregon. It will be my purpose today to discuss Sections 2 and 3 of the proposed bill. However, comments regarding ORS 82.115 and ORS 708.9490 may be in order. Both of these statutory sections were the outgrowth of Senate Bill 259, which was passed in the 1975 session. The purpose of Senate Bill 259 was to allow borrowers to obtain FHA and other United States government-sponsored loans at times when effective interest rates exceed those generally allowed under Oregon law. The exemption granted by the Act to achieve this purpose was, it appears, based on the belief that interest charges on such loans are totally established by the federal government. Although the contract rate of interest is established by one or more federal agencies, it is the operation of the long-term money market that ultimately establishes the cost of money to the borrower. Sections 2 and 3 of Senate Bill 1025 contain housekeeping changes which we believe not only clarify the original intent of the legislation, but also makes both the FHA and the Veterans Administration loan programs readily available to consumers regardless of the cyclical swings of economic activity and resultant fluctuation of interest rates. Since the creation of the Federal Housing Administration in 1934, and later the Veterans Administration Loan Program, as a result of the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act of 1944, literally thousands of Oregonians have been able to purchase their homes under favorable terms these programs offer. We respectfully urge your support in passage of Senate Bill 1025. This timely passage will ensure a steady flow of funds from sources outside the state to support Oregon's continued growth.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roberts.
Just for my own clarification, we've been talking a great deal about individuals wanting to buy their own homes, but if this bill in this form is passed, the way I read it, and please correct me because I'm not really sure what part of the language means. Where it says up to maximum rate of 15% per annum in charge on loans secured by residential real estate. Now, does that mean that we're not only talking about a mortgage on a home, but also perhaps second mortgages, which a borrower may wish to obtain in order to use the money for other purposes, and also does it by residential real estate? Do you mean any housing that is used as residences, which would include investment houses, duplexes, multiple units?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
It would include all facets of housing.
And it would also include the loans for other purposes where the collateral, I don't know if you call it collateral.
The security
would be residential property.
That's correct.
That might be free and clear or might be
encumbered.
Barrows, did you have something?
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chairman, two very brief points. Number one, I think there's some packet that has been passed out to you of our testimony, or some of our testimony, and in the back of that are some amendments, Mr. Chairman, which are very technical in nature. They result from numerous conversations among the
Well, we're going to have a work session on this, Dave.
Okay.
And I think you present your amendments at that time.
All right, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
And it'll probably be in the next...
three pages of them.
Yeah, we have three pages of them here. And we
they're very technical, and all they're a bunch of amendments dealing with attorney arguments.
We have 2 weeks before we get around to this because...
Well, we have other bills, you know, the workman's comp package, but as soon as quickly as possible, and I think that's about as soon as we...
All right. I appreciate that. The other point I'd like to make, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is simply this. We understand that the home builders are going to come out and speak in opposition to this today. And obviously we're not going to have a chance to refute their comments. We find the position absolutely untenable, really unbelievable. On the one hand, they strongly have supported over the years the veterans program in the state of Oregon. On the basis of that brings in out-of-state money. On the other hand, they say that we don't want any out-of-state money if it's going to result in interest rate more than 10% for conventional loans. I position totally inconsistent and untenable, and just do not understand how they can talk on both points at the same time. We appreciate the committee's courtesy, Mr. Chairman, allowing us to appear today.
Thank you, Dave. Roy Ashbar, Oregon Home Builders Association. Ashbar, I'm sorry.
My name is Roy Ashbar. I'm a building contractor in Portland, Oregon. I'm currently president of the Home Builders Association in Metropolitan Portland. And I'm here today representing the Oregon State Home Builders Association. And I have the unenviable task of opposing bankers. I would like to move my testimony brief to the point. The Oregon State Home Builders Association would like to go on record as opposing Section 1 ORS 82.010 as defined in Senate Bill 1025. The passage of this section we feel is untimely. There is not a present need to increase the usury limits. In the recent period of tight money of 1973-74, the usury limits acted as a lid on mortgage rates and prevented runaway interest rates. Because of the commodity market for mortgage funds, i.e. supply-demand, there is a need to limit interest rates, and the current limit has proven satisfactory and is still the test of time. As to the argument that without higher limits, mortgage funds will not be available, the Oregon State Home Builders Association members have found that trying to sell homes with interest rates approaching 10% is almost impossible. This also applies to some small duplexes and rental property, as they are unable to compete in the rental market with these high rates. There are presently ample mortgage funds at below 9% rate for residential construction. There is no pending crisis on the horizon, and there is no need to change the current law. There is a definite need for constraints on interest rates. With rates above 10%, the industry would be severely injured, even for the short term. Because for the few that could afford to pay the excessively high rates, it would most definitely be at the expense of a large share of the home building industry. As in the fact that the rates in California may currently be somewhat less, I think it should be pointed out that California is currently experimenting with variable interest rates, which has not been pointed out. Also, it may be of interest that more than half of the states have a usury limit of 10% or less at the current time. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any question? Can I make a short comment?
Sure.
Your testimony makes me think that there is something left in the free market economy. Have you found, in your experience, you've found that the banks or the financial institutions that are lending money and mortgages, have they gone? The testimony of 8.75% is about as high as they go. Do you find that
that is correct. That is our experience at the present time. It was defined that it was an 80% convention line. That is approximately the current rate.
8.75. Have you seen where they've gone up to 9.75 or
nine? Not for an 80% property. And my experience now, I'm talking about new residential construction. I don't know what specific interest that you raise. My experience, I'm a home builder. I'm selling new houses, and the rates that we are currently paying, or our customers are currently paying, are approximately 8.75.
Any further questions? If not, thank you. I hope that you have no trouble with your banker in financing future loans. John Foreman.
Thank you. explain the following reason I represent myself. Senator's already made my point. I'm concerned about this thing being a two-way street. I agree in free funds, free flow of money both ways, but the proposal is a one-way street. This is thing about even the interest rate cycles high is not the rate itself, but prepayment penalties. That the savings and loan insurance comes a salary used to lock in high rates for the life of loan, or at least for an extended time. By law, the savings and loan have a ceiling on the interest they pay to depositors, so their money costs are pretty well fixed. And interest factors built into life insurance policies never change. But once these institutions are able to loan money at peak rates, they make it impractical for the borrower to refinance when interest rates come down to a basis providing normal margins to the money loan investor. In many cases, the borrower can't even pay off a loan without paying when he sells the mortgage property. Many people are not aware of how costly this trap can be. And even though they know they are helpless to do anything about it, they really need a loan. Therefore, if the usury level is raised, by all means, amend the bill to make it unlawful to charge prepayment penalties on any real estate loan in Oregon, be it residential or business, and irrespective of the size of the loan. A mortgage is a mortgage. Anything that acts to keep a person or business from reducing debt cannot be in the public interest. To provide reasonable cost protection to both parties, the restrictions might be made to apply after 1 year. That is, the law might read a prepayment penalty on any real estate loan in Oregon is illegal after the loan is 1 year old. This is simply a matter of allowing the consumer to back out of a bad deal after a reasonable period without injury to either party. Obviously, the only purpose of a prepayment penalty is to limit competition and to keep interest rates high. That's my statement, sir. Any questions?
Are there any questions? If not, thank you, Foreman. I just wanted to ask the witness, for just a moment, I think that, Jan, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a very brief one. What brought you to an interest in this?
Personal experience.
You're here just testifying as
an individual.
Right.
I think the problem we have...
Okay.
Most individuals, like myself, where we don't read the fine print. And the fine print is things like prepayment penalties, and I like Senator Groner's suggestion. He beat me to the punch on that one, which I appreciate. So.
Aren't you signed up?
I don't see any problem letting these people have whatever interest rate the marketplace demands. But it should be a two-way street. You shouldn't be locked into that situation. There should be some escape. You should be able to refinance without penalty. And the way it is now, you can't. In most loans, you cannot refinance. Maybe if they want to be completely honest about it, let them index their loans and let the rates go up and down with the marketplace. But what they're asking you for is a completely one-way street, and I don't think that's fair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foreman. That will conclude the hearing on
10:25,
and we'll go to 10:48. For preface the hearing on 10:48, I would like to thank the following people for the work and their contribution they made in making this bill possible, especially the cooperation that we've had between labor and management, and this has been really, has been a session, one of the better sessions, and I think it will be for most members of this committee to know that labor and management has worked together in coming up with a package. I think that maybe it's not exactly what they want, but it's been a great deal of compromise, and still will probably be a little compromise when we get into these bills. But I'd like to thank Bob Kennedy, President of the FL-CIO, LB Day with the Teamsters, Carl Frederick, AOI, Dick Bransky with attorney for AGC, George Lewis with AWPPW, Chuck Gill with SAFE, and Jack Kalinowski with AGC, Dave Krieger, a trial attorney, and Tom Murphy, also a trial attorney, Roy Green.
Luther Clevenger, Chuck Lawson, Jim Markey, Evelyn Scott Ferris, representing insurance companies, Alder Thurman, Ken Gibson, and Patty Holden is with the AFL-CIO and a student intern for the AFL-CIO, a remarkable little girl. But all this we appreciate, and the help that we've had in getting both factions together on this bill. And we're going to call on our leadoff witness, I think, appealing appropriate, that Bob Kennedy with the AFL-CIO.
Were those the credits that you were giving after receiving an Oscar, Mr. Chairman?
I haven't received that yet. We'll wait after it goes through.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Bob Kennedy, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO cannot support Senate Bill 1048 in the present form because the injured worker cannot afford to take the additional losses as are proposed in this bill. Now, many workers have lost boats, campers, pickups, cars, and other property because they have been injured on the job and have had to sell these items to live or because they could not continue the payments while awaiting an award as a PTD. On page 2A, sub A, that was age, has been omitted in the new language that has been added. In performing and learning a new job or trade, age is a very important factor. A 25-year-old is usually more able to return to classroom situations than a 58-year-old. It has been proven in many apprenticeship programs that an older worker did not do as well as a younger person. Therefore, you find age limits in most bona fide apprenticeship and training programs, which helps to prove this point of retraining older workers. When a worker suffers a permanent total disability, PTD, the benefits that he or she is enjoying as a full-time employee will terminate after varying lengths of time. These benefits may have been negotiated or voluntarily given by the employer, such as medical and hospital coverage, prescription drugs, discounts on services or products the employer produces, such as the phone company might give discounts to the employees. I got them when I worked for a dairy. Employers of truck dealers I know of gives discounts on vehicles. Social Security and other pension plans, contributions, and premiums cease and will not increase benefits of the pensions at normal retirement date. A worker that becomes a PTD will never know to what height he or she might have reached in his or her field, which would usually carry an increase in remuneration and benefits. It is very possible that many injured workers would have progressed up the ladder of success had they not been injured, made sizable fortunes, or in any event, considerably more than the job they were performing at the time of the injury. Because of the loss of the foregoing benefits, we have been reluctant to give up any workman's compensation benefits for injured workers. We realize the pressure from the employers on the legislators for reducing costs of workman's compensation premiums. I want you to understand labor is just as concerned, if not more so, for the injured workers' welfare as the employer representatives are of their clients. This bill, with an amendment, has many saving features for the employers because, one, if a worker is gainfully employed, the income will be offset. And two, after age 65, reduction in disability benefits scaled down 50% down to zero at age 70. These two items will save huge amounts of money for the employer. And I hope this legislature does not get stampeded into a cost-cutting spree just to save money without regard to the injured worker. Injured workers are not freeloaders. There are always a small percentage of people that may beat any system. So I challenge anyone to show us those that are cheating on workman's compensation because they can be taken care of through the Workman's Compensation Board. In its original form, Senate Bill 1048 is very arbitrary And I admit we have been arbitrary in our amendment by using age 65 to cut workman's compensation benefits. I have known many persons that have been employed where there was a mandatory age 65 retirement rule. Because of obligations they had, they retired and then they went to work somewhere else. So please keep in mind that age, that 65 is a figure, not a fact, for all retirees. The state of Michigan used the graduated reduction starting at age 65 as we have proposed in the amendment. To keep an incentive for an injured worker to attempt to return to work, I would hope that when the periodic examinations are made of the PTD, the consideration will be given to this question. The quality of life has not been addressed in this bill, nor in our amendment. And what I refer to is that, for instance, should a person lose a hand and they were in part of this, that would bring them to become a permanent total disability. They would then suffer the consequences of that until the day that they die. And I hope that you would not forget that as well. The Oregon AFL-CIO respectfully submits the attached amendment to Senate Bill 1040 to apply to future permanent total disability claimants. The amendment needs to be corrected on page 2, third sentence from the bottom of the page. The word disputable should be replaced by conclusive. And Mr. Chairman, possibly I should read these proposed amendments. Everyone has them there, but for the benefit of the audience. On page 2 of the printed bill, line 10, after quote, perform unquote, insert quote, comma, considering the workman's age, unquote. And line 30, delete quote, at the time, unquote. And line 31, delete quote first, unquote, and insert quote who also, unquote, and in the same line, delete all and insert, quote, shall receive all medical care benefits, plus, some colon, unquote. Delete lines 32 and 33 and insert A, at age 65, 50% of the amount of previously paid permanent total disability benefits. B, at age 60, 40% of the amount of previously paid permanent total disability benefits. C, at age 67, 30% of the amount of the previously paid permanent total disability benefits. D, at age 68, 20% of the amount of previously paid permanent total disability benefits. E, at age 69, 10% of the amount of previously paid permanent total disability. F, at age 70 and thereafter, 0% of the amount of previously paid permanent total disability benefits. On page 3, line 1, delete sub B and insert 6 in addition to the benefits provided in subsection 5 of this section. The workman referred to in that the subsection shall receive, and that's unquote. In line 3, after the period, insert, quote, for the purpose of this subsection, it shall be conclusive, presumed that the workman has made the maximum total contribution to Social Security, unquote. In line 4, delete 6 and insert 7, unquote. And that concludes the testimony.
We can have the staff mark up a bill like this, the AFL proposal for amendments to this bill, so we could have, the committee could have it prior to our next meeting. I would appreciate it. Okay. Are there any questions of Bob? Bob, your proposal then is to phase out the permanent total benefits over a period of years since up until age 70. And starting at age 65?
Starting at age 65, it would be cut to 50%.
I see.
And then 10% less each year.
Until it's zero at age 70?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
I have one. Bob, on the definition of permanent total disability, you suggest the insertion of considering the workman's age. Does that solve all the problems you have with that new definition of gainful and suitable employment?
Right. The thing about this on that, there's some persons that happen to be, we'll let it stand if that's the answer.
Any further questions by members of the committee? If not, we'll call on George Burney, the American Insurance Association.
Chairman, my name is George Burney for the American Insurance Association, which is a trade association of companies writing, among other insurance, workman's compensation insurance, and perhaps about 25% of the premium written in Oregon. It is in favor and supports this bill without any amendments. We anticipate there might be some that we might object to, and the principal one being might be suggestion that there be a Social Security disability offset. That we are opposed to. And if that is offered, I'd like to have an opportunity to be heard with respect to it.
Well,
thank you very much.
Why would the insurance companies represent oppose a Social Security offset? The only reason I could see is that it would reduce your premiums and probably your commissions, you know, if there is a Social Security offset. For what reason would they oppose a Social Security, which will save the employers of this state's money?
Well,
aren't you interested in saving the employers of the state as a representative of the insurance industry?
Well, I can say that our prime concern is to keep in business, and that's kind of difficult to worry.
Oh, in other words, you're worried that this might be a trend that is...
No, I'm not worried about that, Mr. Chairman. I'm worried about the reason why we think that this is not an important matter, insofar as a cost-saving device is concerned.
Go ahead.
Be nice to Mr.
I'll try to answer your question.
He's a lawyer. He's nice.
We think that the cost savings in this, there will be savings in premium costs to employers. They will amount to about 1.5% increase.
To a 1.5% increase
in premium costs if this disability offset is provided. In other words, it'll cost the employers that they will have a 1.5% decrease, 1.5% savings if we do adopt an amendment offsetting disability, Social Security disability payments.
1.5%
savings. 1.5%.
Let me ask you this. Why is it your concern? You're concerned it's only a 1.5% saving, just as the employers of this state feel that there'd be a substantial saving, or considerably more than that. Or do you have knowledge that they don't have?
Well, our only knowledge would be this national commission. These are the figures of a national commission, which in states comparable to Oregon, say California and our neighbors, where they have had, I don't know what California has, but the states that have had these disability offsets, the premium has been only 1.5% savings. So that's the National Commission.
Well, that may be the National Commission. I think only in recent history have other states such as Washington utilized the Social Security offset. So I don't know how the National Commission, or you speak alluding to the commission that President Nixon appointed to study the workman's comp problem?
No, I'm talking about the one that fixes the compensation rates.
Oh, that's the one back in New York. The National Bureau, you mean it?
Yeah, the National Bureau. It has a branch.
No, I think that they have reason to be concerned that they would accept the Social Security offset, because I would presume their income would that the people they really represent would could be limited to a lesser extent in premium volume if we do adopt the Social Security offset. Otherwise, I just can't see your concern.
Well, all I ask, Mr. Chairman, is that if this amendment is adopted, that I be given time in order to fully explain the position of my client. And I'm sure that after you see that of all the arguments that we have and the studies we've made, that you may know what our basis of our position is.
Could you have written all that testimony available to the committee is why? And I think that could we the committee have benefited of that at any time? I'd like to see a copy of your written testimony where you can prove this point and where you have the evidence that this would only result in a 1.5% saving.
Yeah, well, I can give you the information that comes to me, and maybe you can be further supported.
Okay.
But this is not a new concept, Mr. Chairman. This has been the committee that studied this in the interim. It knows about our position, as have all of the factors and people represented on the committee that you gave thanks to. And I, in turn, and my client, in turn, congratulates that committee.
Thank you, Mr. Burney.
Yeah. Now, could I be heard, though, if it is adopted?
Fine.
Thank you very much.
Do you have a question, Senator Wires?
Yes, I'd just like to ask Mr. Chairman, Mr. Burney, if he's going to be heard further on Social Security offset, if you would also comment on, at that time, on the effect this might have on the Social Security.
That's a part of our position, the effect that it will have on Social Security.
And the reaction of the Social Security system, or that the Congress might, how they might react to this.
Yes, and also in the Social Security Administration. Now, the disability is a separate fund from old age and survivorship pension system. They are two separate funds. The disability situation is much more critical than is a survivorship. But that I can bring out at a later
time. You will be able to bring
it. I'll be able to bring that out.
Fine, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, George.
Thank you.
Next, T.F. Connolly with American Insurance Alliance. American Mutual Insurance Alliance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Connolly, the American Mutual Insurance Alliance, likewise a trade association which represents mutual property and casualty companies. We, too, support the concept that is embodied in this bill, and the only comments that I have really are mechanical or administrative kinds of concerns. Mr. Kennedy has attempted to meet in the amendment he offered with respect to subsection B that appears at the top of page 3, where he would have you incorporate in the bill an assumption or a presumption that the contributions made on behalf of the worker were the maximum contributions. Our concern with B is not so much how it's done as much as it is that the present wording doesn't give any guidance, and while we're willing to try anything in terms of the computing these kinds of things, we see some very practical difficulties. That's one of them. If you build into the statute a presumption that the worker has earned the maximum earnings and the contributions have been maximum, that certainly makes the calculation easy, but it may include a presumption that's not warranted.
That's where the worker has been injured prior to the age 65.
That's correct.
And you presume that his earnings would be such when he reaches the age 65.
Well, you presume that from the time he's injured until he's 65, he would have earned wages that would have entitled him to a maximum contribution.
Right.
Now, it could be that the same effect could be achieved by simply including in that provision the authority to the board or to the department, whatever it ends up being, to make rules regulating the calculation of this amount. If you set it into the statute, then it's in there, and if we find out that that isn't the right way, we're going to have to come back and ask that it's changed. And we have no, I think our preference would be that the board
the rules
have an opportunity to listen to the various alternatives And perhaps what would work for one worker may not work for another worker.
George Moore was going to testify shortly with the board, and I hope he would allude to that.
I think we would like to see a bit more coordination in the two provisions, one which appears on page 2, which requires the worker to file annual income information, and the one on page 3 that requires the insurer to conduct periodic examinations. It may be that under Oregon law, it would not be proper for the insurer to become privy to the information on income, but it would be good, I think, that if the board receives information indicating that a particular worker is receiving more or equal
What line are you on?
On page 2, beginning at line 21, there is a requirement that workers receiving these benefits file annually with the board evidence of their income. On page 3, beginning at line 4, there is a requirement that each insurer conducts a separate examination of each case on some kind of periodic basis. I would like to suggest that it may not be necessary or economical for every single case to be reviewed periodically. There are some cases I think that would be obviously, we wouldn't benefit at all. For instance, if you take a workman that's a paraplegic or is blind, there isn't much sense in trying to reevaluate that. That's going to be expensive to do, and no benefit is going to be obtained. And I'm wondering whether we might consider a concept where, in any case where the board, through its income tax filings or its income information filings, determines that there is a case for potential reevaluation, if it could have the obligation to notify the insurer, and the insurer in those cases would be obligated to do it. And then in all other cases, rather than the insurer being required to evaluate, that it be permissive, so that there'd be some selection as to the cases where it's most likely that some benefit can be obtained. The provision beginning at line 4 on page 3 will necessitate some expense. If every single case has to be reevaluated at whatever the period is.
Under the existing law, can't the insurer examine and check if the subject injured workman has in fact been gone back to work?
That's my understanding, Senator.
Why don't you do it?
I have been told by our companies that they do that.
Well, that's what we hear.
They don't do it on every case. Do it only on those cases where some information comes to them that the man is back at work. But
don't you check?
This
is costing the system plenty because insurance companies have been negligent in checking this.
All right. It also costs the insurance companies money to hire investigators to do that. So you reach a balance. Is it worth it? Is it worth the extra expense to justify the reduction, which maybe wouldn't be all that much? And that's the balance that they strike. They have also, I'm told, not had an awful lot of success in pressing cases in attempting to get reductions with the board. And so, you know, sooner or later you get tired of beating your head against the wall. I think that's the attitude that's been adopted. Those really are the only suggestions that we have, other than to say that the concept is something that we certainly support, and it's kind of nice to be in front of you and supporting something. Rather,
did you have the proposed amendment drafted?
No, I don't. I don't really have any specific.
Or
as far as the thing on the presumption that where Mr. Kennedy put a specific amendment in, we have no particular feelings about that. If you build that presumption in, I think the costs are going to be more ascertainable. But to insurance companies, it really does not make any difference on the basis of the computation as long as we have some guidance as to how it's to be done. I would like to make a comment about the Social Security offset and clarify something that Mr. Booney indicated, the 1.5%. That is a different offset than the one that's in here now. The one that's in here now would result in a reduction that's higher than 1.5%. If added to this, and we understand that there will be amendments suggested to the committee, if you add to this to the offsets that are already in this bill, one for disability payments for workers below age 65,
Right.
The additional savings, according to the National Council, would be only another point and a half if you add things for death benefits in addition to what's already here. The savings are greater. We oppose those two, and I can just briefly, in response to your question, it would not especially be detrimental to insurance companies to have a reduced amount of premium on a particular risk, because what that would do would be to free up some of their surplus to write more risks. But what we are concerned about on offsets primarily is that this is a state system. It is mandated at a state level. It is controlled at a state level. And we see a danger in turning over a substantial portion of it to a system over which none of us have any control. The Social Security system is, we feel if enough benefits came from that source, there would be a disincentive to engage in rehabilitative and other efforts that benefit the workman. And we think that the control ought to remain at the state level. But it would not be detrimental if we lose premium on a particular risk, because we can use it to write a premium on another risk. It's really not detrimental at all.
How are we going to lose control when it's 1.5%, as you say, maybe 1.5-3% saving? How is the state going to lose control when that's the maximum that, in your own testimony, that Social Security is going to pay?
Well, it would on the disability. We're not concerned with the other thing. It's a foot in the door kind of approach. That is the estimate that would be at this time.
You're afraid the state might go two way as a result of that, or
no? Really, that doesn't enter into it at all. Because even if it's a two-way system, and the only writer of insurance is, say, a state fund, and you also have self-insurance, the state fund has the same potential of losing that control. There are benefit dollars being paid over which the state really doesn't have much authority or much reason to exercise some kind of control over the rehabilitative or whatever processes there are.
1.5-2% is not that much to...
It isn't today, but the foot in the door. We're concerned about the effect of the influence effect, the foot in the door.
Any further questions, Senator Wires?
On that same point, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Woodens, the foot in the door. Are you concerned that if we start having Social Security offset, that we might end up with a federal workman's compensation program? Is that what you mean by foot in the door?
That would be one of the aspects we'd be concerned about. Yeah. There.
And as far as the loss of state control, that would be a total loss of state control.
Under some of the federal proposals, there would be. That's correct. Some of the proposals at the federal level have just been for standards, which the states would have to meet, but retain control of those. Of administering the standards. There are some proposals, though, that would go completely to a federal system so that the state wouldn't be involved in the program at all anymore.
Well, I'm kind of, I guess, putting words in your mouth, because I feel like that you're trying to explain to us, but you're not wording out all the things that you're thinking. I hope that's not unfair to you to say that, but let me try putting some more words in your mouth, see how you react to that. Are you concerned that it could be used as a justification for a complete federal takeover for those who are arguing for it, being able to assert, look, they're already using the Social Security set-off here?
Yes. That's a piece of it. That's not the sole justification for our opposition, but that's a part of it. It's a part of our concern. I have, incidentally, a paper that I prepared on Social Security offsets, and I'm sorry I don't have it with me, but I can send it here.
Let me ask you this. Why was it you was afraid to tell the committee that? Senator Wires had to drag it out of you.
No, I wasn't afraid.
I mean, you said it with your concern was it was only a 1.5% saving, the saving wasn't substantial, therefore this was your reason for opposing it. And finally, when he puts words in your mouth, you agree that you're afraid of federal takeover.
Well, I said that when I talked about the foot in the door. I haven't gone down my checklist one by one because I don't have it in front of me, Senator, but I did say that we were concerned that what it was going to do would be to have an influence on more of that, and that there would be continuing intrusion into the state system of federal. That was implicit
in my remarks whether it was inferred or not.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Keneally. Steve Telfer with Association Oregon Counties, League of Oregon City, Oregon School Boards Association with amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Telfer. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and the Oregon School Boards Association. My testimony will be rather brief. The Oregon Local Government Associations are basically in support of SB 1048. The bill addresses two of the priority issues in a position paper jointly adopted by the three organizations I am representing. Specifically, number one, a redefinition of permanent total disability in order to reduce worker compensation costs, and number two, an offset of worker compensation benefits for workers who are permanently and totally disabled and who have reached the age they would normally be withdrawn from the workforce. It's my belief that serious consideration and adoption of the amendments proposed or that will be proposed by the Association of Oregon Industries would further improve the legislation in terms of meeting our priority goals. The odd lot doctrine, which has been one of the irritants in Oregon's permanent total disability problem, would be cleanly eliminated with the proposed AOI amendments. We would be supportive of adopting the concept of, quote, substantial gainful employment, which is presently used in the Federal Social Security Act as a substitute for the existing gainful and suitable criteria used to evaluate PTD cases. Seems to me this proposal would be an added incentive for the employer to encourage rehabilitation and job tailoring to permit the employee who would otherwise have fallen into the odd lot doctrine or category to permit and to remain, employed and active. We are very supportive of offsetting benefits at retirement on the basis of the difference between benefits actually received and those that would have been received without injury. This concept helps return the system to an insurance program rather than a welfare or pension program. And I might add that here again, we wish to make the distinction between retirement and the disability, which the previous witnesses testified to.
You've heard the Kennedy proposal, Steve, where the FLCI proposes phasing it out from age 65, 50% of 65, 10%.
Graduated concept.
Acceptable, I mean.
Well, I think we prefer to see it the way we recognize the AOI will be presenting on a full basis, just on the difference between what would have been earned had there been no injury and that was actually awarded. But certainly the concept that Mr. Kennedy is raising is worthwhile. Finally, and here's where your Oscar comes, I'd like the record to note and we are very appreciative of Senator Groner's efforts to get labor and management together to bring about needed changes in the Oregon workers' compensation system. This bill is a constructive product of that effort, and we will continue to support the concepts embodied in SB 1048 and the AOI amendment. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate that, Oscar, and I can probably eat higher on the hog with that after all the accolades here.
I don't know. Kind of suspicious.
Our next witness is Roy Green. Roy here? Roy Green and we'll bring up Carl Frederick at the same time.
Roy seems kind of shook.
And anyone else? Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the Academy. We really thought we had it. And I take issue that you should be given an Oscar. Mr. Green suggested that perhaps you be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Although we're going to offer some amendments to Senate Bill 1048, we are generally in agreement with the thrust of the measure. The bill is most significant in addressing some very critical problem areas and attempting to arrive at a solution to each of these problems. Firstly, there is an attempt in the bill to
to redefine permanent total disability, first instance. Secondly, the measure does spell out that the worker has the burden of proving permanent total disability status. Thirdly, the bill speaks to the problem of monitoring these very expensive cases with certain responsibilities imposed for reporting earnings on the worker, and again, certain responsibilities for reexamination on the part of the insurer. And finally, the bill does recognize the fiscal implication of these cases and provides for financing, at least partial financing, from a source outside the workman's compensation, the Oregon Workman's Compensation Program. And we think all of these points are commendable. True, we do have some proposed amendments. They're primarily in two areas. Definitional, we don't feel that the language in on page 2, lines 9 and 10, addressed the problem of the odd lot doctrine. That was the intent, to limit that, or to perhaps eliminate it entirely. Language we have proposed will, in fact, eliminate the odd lot doctrine. As far as the Social Security offsets, we are concerned about the possibility of extending it to include disability as well as retirement, and our amendments will speak to that also.
Can you move to the testimony of the insurance industry?
I beg your pardon?
To the insurance industry, it'd be only a 1.5% saving, and to the testimony of George Burney and Mr.
Well, I don't know if the figure is accurate, but 1.5% of
$250 million
is $4.5 million, isn't it, actuary?
$300 million, $60 million,
4.5%. Well, it's significant. I might point out there are four states that do have offsets in practice at the present time. Montana has had a 6% offset for TTD and permanent total disability since 1971. Florida has, since 1972, has had 100% offset on permanent total disability only. Colorado, since 1973, has a 50% offset for temporary total disability and permanent total disability. In Washington, since 1975, has a 100% offset for temporary total disability and permanent total disability.
What was the savings? Do you know what the savings was in Washington?
I don't have those figures. I did check with a multi-state employer. We represent three of these areas and three of the states, and they have no problems administratively, and it has resulted in significant savings.
Let me ask, do you share the fears of the insurance industry that there could be a federal takeover in event that we do use a Social Security offset?
No. They're already into the system now, except the offset goes the other way, obviously.
Right. Okay, Senator Trowe?
I wanted to ask you, do you share any of the other reservations of Mr. Burney about the Social Security offset?
No, absolutely not. We're concerned about costs, and we feel this would be a significant cost factor. And Wright, do you have any?
Well, there are some additional administrative costs involved with it, undoubtedly. But I think that's one of the problems that the insurance industry is going to have to face. Basically, as far as the employers are concerned, we feel that any extreme disincentive to return to work, such as the piling of benefits one on the other, is bad for the system, period. And really to have, for example, a Social Security takeover, all Social Security, all such piling on of benefits would be eliminated. So I doubt seriously I think it's eventual that it's going to come about, but I don't think it's in the next 20 years. Secondly, the problem that we run into, especially with the permanent total disability claimants of a younger age, where possibly there are benefits that he can get medically at a later date, which will put him in a position to be employed, often are ignored by someone who has sufficient retirement income for the rest of their life to
enjoy at least a modicum of good living conditions. That legislates flatly against any return to work, and this is one of the things we're concerned about. And incidentally, some of our recommendations for amendment point to this same question.
Do we have your amendments?
No, I have them here, sir.
Okay.
I presume you'll hold a work session.
What we'd like to do is have the AOI amendments marked up in a bill too, Connie.
Along with the first set?
Both, in two bills. One with the AOI amendments, one with the AFL-CIO amendments.
Okay.
Pardon? Mr. Chairman.
Senator Drove?
Yeah.
Your amendment is sort of designed to do away with the odd lot doctrine completely, right? And the AFL-CIO amendment is sort of considering the age, putting that on, tends, I think, to allow some of the odd lot doctrine. Right? Is that the difference between
that
the two separate amendments?
That's one of the differences, although I think adding the age on will have a minimal effect.
You would object to adding age there?
No, because one of our...
Are you changing the language completely with your amendment?
On line 9, yes, sir.
Uh-huh.
Would you want to read those?
Yeah, our amendments specifically would take out of the bill as presently printed lines 9 and 10, the added language, and we would remove the term "and suitable." It would be performing work at any gainful employment. Plus, we would integrate language from the Social Security law with respect to defining substantial gainful employment, because we are, again, integrating payments under Social Security. We thought we ought to use that type of language. And that essentially is in this area.
Senator Wires, you would take out the last word in line 8 and the first word in line 9?
Yes.
So it would read,
performing work at any gainful occupation.
You take out suitable then?
Yes, and yeah, suitable.
You're taking out suitable.
Perhaps after these are marked up,
yeah,
it's done.
What provision would you make, or is that going to be in another bill to make some provision for the difference between the work that they are able to do after the injury and the work they're able to do before? If you take the word "suitable" out, that would mean they accept any employment. That
I think you're alluding to permanent partial disability, aren't you, rather than permanent total. Or there is a provision in 1049, if I recall. For
then what's your intent in taking the word "suitable" out?
Well, we understand that the only way to eliminate the odd lot doctrine is to take those two words out and redefine permanent total disability as regular performing work at any gainful occupation.
Mr. Chairman, yes, wasn't the purpose of the language as inserted in here to pretty much do away with the odd lot doctrine anyway? The language is already there, but you don't think it did.
I honestly don't think it does. Something we might want to do.
But it was the intention. Yeah. Does the language as put in take away a whole lot of it and just maybe lose a little bit of it, or what?
I personally don't feel it does anything.
You don't think it gets
it at
all?
I don't think it gets at the definition.
Senator, a little earlier says, as used in this section, a suitable occupation is one in which the workman has the physical ability and the training or experience to perform. It eliminates entirely employing one of these workmen and training him on the job for a job, for example. There is no reference in this bill to the fact that a workman can refuse vocational rehabilitation and still be eligible for permanent total disability. Both of those things we have included in our amendment. We feel that, among other things, that
during the period of the negotiations?
Did
you offer this language during the period of the negotiations about what happened here?
No, not precisely. No, we talked generally, and this is a consensus bill in a sense that we agreed to disagree in certain areas. But we're quite close.
We agreed that we thought that something should be done about the Odd-Lot Doctrine, but I think that they thought that this language would help somewhat.
Yeah.
The language in the present bill.
There are some other areas of concern in the bill which are not in our remarks here. Benefits which are changes which are substantive normally take effect as of the effective date of the act for injuries occurring on and after that date. Those which are procedural take effect for all existing permanent totals. And I have a question as to paragraph 6, whether this is procedural or substantive, and I hope to be able to get an answer on that. The re-examination. Now, there was a question raised, I believe, regarding the two-year requirement for examination. The way this paragraph 6 is worded, the re-examination shall include such medical examination and reports as the insurers consider necessary or the board may require. In other words, I don't believe that the wording here requires that every permanent total be physically examined not less than every 2 years. If it is a statutory permanent total, it is obviously be foolish to examine him because he's eligible for permanent total, irrespective of what the examination shows.
Is that there's some flexibility in that then for the insurance?
I think right there is. Yes.
It's not a categoric requirement that they re-examine everybody.
There is a question in this bill that hasn't been resolved in my mind yet, and that is that there is an intimation in the bill that the board has the right has a right to modify previous findings. They have that right now. But in section 2E, or paragraph 2E of section 3, it appears that there may be by implication a right to adjust the permanent total benefits, and this may be a problem because currently there is no right of the board. You're either permanently totally disabled and receive the benefits to which you're entitled either statutorily or under the retroactive reserve, or you're permanently and partially disabled.
George Moore has signed up to testify on the bill. Probably this is something that he would like to offer.
Also, it might be well to set an emergency date on this bill. It's a little bit easier to administer if it has a date of July 1st, 1977, and properly George would talk to that.
July 1
of 77 or January 1 of 78 or some okay. Exact date.
Any further questions, Carl? Do you have anything further, or
no,
Roy? Anything further to offer? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Our next witness is Jack Kalinowski, Associated General Contractors.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm testifying in favor of House Bill, or Senate Bill 1048. I don't have any amendments to offer, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that a lot of us will have the opportunity to work on those amendments that have been presented to the committee. But I thought it very important to convey to the committee one of the reasons why we're in support of this bill and other bills leading to some reform in the workman's compensation field in the state of Oregon.
Prior to the convening of this session of the legislature, I asked one of our building contractors to assume that he was building a school building, let's say, in the state of Washington, and to figure what his, in his bid, what he would have to assume for workman's compensation insurance costs. I asked him to do that and to make the same estimation as if he were bidding such a building in the state of Oregon. He called me back in a couple of days and told me that his workman's compensation costs in Oregon would be three times what they would be in Washington to build the same building. Following that conversation, I went a little further and I did some checking. As a matter of fact, as late as 12:45 today, with the Workman's Compensation Department of the state of Washington in Olympia. And I thought I would share with you the rates that are being paid by construction contractors, those that that I represent, in the state of Washington, and compared to the state of Oregon. And these are the major trades that we employ.
That's as of the present time, what they're paying.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to explain that.
Okay.
As I think just about everybody knows, in the state of Washington, they recently experienced a 75% increase in their workman's compensation premium costs. That was a 37.5% increase effective January 1, 1977. And another 37.5% effective July 1, 1977. The information I'm going to give you right now is the rates that will be in effect on July 1 after this 75% increase in the state of Washington has taken place. And I have six such categories that I'm going to give you. And again, repeating, these are the major jobs that are crafts that we employ. In the first, Mr. Chairman, without necessarily identifying the crafts, in the state of Washington, the rate per $100 of payroll that the employer pays is $6.58.
On what type of work?
I can identify these if you will, but this covers generally six. You could call it street or road construction, or sewer construction generally.
Would that be now under the 75% increase?
This will be the rate in Washington effective July 1, 1977. $6.58 per $100 of payroll. In Oregon, for the same crafts, we pay $11.06 on up to $20.18 per $100 of payroll. Now, as a rule of thumb, you can assume almost that the difference in the in what I'm giving you is the added cost per day that a construction contractor in Oregon will pay for every employee that he employs out of these crafts. In this one particular case, for example, it'll range from about $5 to about $14 additional per day.
I'd like to know the classification. What are they, loggers
This is people employed doing street or road construction.
Okay.
Excavation, tunneling, sewer construction, and other underground construction.
It's up to $11.06 to $20 a day, and or $20 a hundred in Oregon, right?
Yes, up to $20 per $100 of payroll. While in Washington, for the same people, it's $6.58. For concrete construction, in Washington, the rate is $5, or will be, July 1, 1977, $5.23 per $100 of payroll. In Oregon, it ranges from $8.99 to $12.53 per $100 of payroll. For carpentry, and you just heard on another bill some testimony concerning housing construction. For carpentry, in Oregon, we pay $11.83 to $18.45 per $100 of payroll. In Washington, the rate is $6.36. Costs us 2 to 3 times as much for workman's compensation insurance as it does in the state of Washington. Sand or gravel digging, $5.20 in Washington compared to $16.48 in Oregon. 3 times as much after they have had a 75% increase. Asphalt works, and you know how hard it is to finance highways. In Washington, they pay $4.28 per $100 of payroll. In Oregon, we pay $7.39 to $14.36 per $100 of payroll. For our permanent yards, $2.08 per $100 of payroll in the state of Washington, $7.64 in the state of Washington, nearly 4 times as much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I ask Mr. Kalinowski, would these contrasting figures be consistent if you used other states other than Washington?
I can't tell you, Senator Trow. We do know that that Oregon has the highest rates in the nation. We do know that in each of our 4 surrounding states, the rates are less. And we do know, I think that some committees of this legislature have heard testimony that logging contractors, for instance, in southern Oregon are losing work because we have an interstate compact. California log truck owners can bring their trucks in to work in the state of Oregon, keep their California insurance rates for workman's compensation, and have a competitive advantage over Oregon log truckers.
Could we find any 1 or 3 states who would have comparable rates to Oregon if we wanted to?
I think you would find some that would begin to approach Oregon. I selected Washington because there's a lot of migration on Oregon construction contractors in and out of the state of Washington. The only other thing that I would want to add, Mr. Chairman, is in this regard, in comparing the state of Washington, in all fairness, is that employees in the state of Washington pay half of what is called the medical aid cost. And in each case, the employees pay about 20%, somewhere between 20 and 30%, depending on the individual job classification, of the total cost of industrial accident insurance in the state of Washington. Addressing specifically Senate Bill 1048, which
if I could break in just a second, does Washington continue its assessment on $100 of payroll? Is that the system they use, or
no? They
use an hour.
They use an hourly exposure, but they in turn. And their department in turn converts this into $100 of payroll and makes a direct comparison for the benefit of anybody who wants to ask.
In your opinion, then, the method of assessment would have no effect one way or the other on premiums, whether we used $100 of payroll or whether we used the Washington type of assessment system, that would be just an even break.
I've heard arguments pro and con. The argument against that is that it really isn't going to make all that much difference because the experience modification is going to adjust whatever the base is. I really don't know, Rich. Specifically addressing Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 1048, I think that enactment of this bill with perhaps some modifications is going to result in a substantial amount of savings to Oregon employers, and I don't think it's really going to be detrimental at all to those who are permanent total disabilities, who have received that classification. I might point out that, in my estimation at any rate, this bill is going to make it a little bit more difficult, perhaps considerably more difficult, for someone who has suffered an injury, an occupational injury, to get the classification of being permanently and totally disabled. But I hope this committee will remember that we right now in the state of Oregon have about one permanent total disability determination, either by the Workman's Compensation Board or by the court system, for every calendar day of the year. We're reaching that point. It's more than one every work day, and it's approaching one every calendar day. With regard to Social Security offsets, Mr. Chairman, about the only thing that I would want to offer here is that this is a system that will work. It can be made to work, and it can be made to work so that it is not at all detrimental to the individual who has been unfortunate enough to suffer an occupational injury. The thing that you have not been told so far in testimony in this regard that I wanted to add is that the Social Security program regarding disability benefits has in effect two pots or two trust funds. One is a disability trust fund in which the Social Security Administration will make payments to a disabled worker until he reaches age 65. At that magical point, they take the money now out of another trust fund called the Retirement Trust Fund. Now, under the present program, as it interworks in the state of Oregon, the Social Security people will deduct from the entitlement for the disabled worker under the age of 65 what he is receiving in the area of workman's compensation. However, at that magical point, his 65th birthday, they no longer make any deduction. So what he is receiving under today's program is the maximum amount of his entitlement for workman's compensation and his maximum entitlement for Social Security retirement benefits, coupled one with the other. And it in effect does become some kind of a windfall. And unless this offset, especially for retirement benefits, and I would think it could be applied to disability benefits for permanent total disability individuals after they have received that classification. Unless that is done, then this windfall kind of thing is going to continue. And I think it's terribly important to remember that 50% of the permanent total disability determinations are for individuals in the state of Oregon who are 50 years of age or over. It's very common knowledge in Oregon that it's easy to receive this classification, and that's really a tremendous incentive to get the double benefits to find oneself in that classification. I think it also important, Mr. Chairman, that this idea of reevaluating take place. In too many cases in the state of Oregon, when an individual is classified as being permanently and totally disabled, he is simply forgotten. The State Accident Insurance Fund pays PTD benefits to several people who do not even reside within the United States. One, I understand, as far away as Italy, and several others in many other foreign lands. There's no attempt made to make a determination as to whether or not that individual or those individuals are, and incidentally, the number over 3,500 whether those individuals are still entitled to this amount of money. What Mr. Green said, and I think it's one of the things he said, and I think it's well worth understanding, is that for permanent total disability benefits, the entitlement is either zip or the total, depending upon the wage he was earning at the time he was injured. This bill allows the Workman's Compensation Board to range in between those figures and to allow them to make a determination to say that he may not be entitled to the full amount. This in itself would be an incentive to the claimant to go out and find a job, even if it is at less pay than he was earning before he was injured, knowing full well that he can work and that he's going to continue to receive at least some benefits from his previous employer's workman's compensation carrier. I think there's an awful lot of meat in this bill, Mr. Chairman, which will do an awful lot for the workman's compensation program in Oregon, and we urge its enactment.
Now, Senator Trove.
Mr. Kalinowski, where in the bill do you get that flexibility?
I'm not doubting what you say. I just want you to know.
In line two, Senator, I still have the feeling, if you'll allow, that I'm going to mispronounce your name again, and I don't really want to get into that kind of
talk. You
would try doing that, I'm sure. In page two, lines 27, 28, and 29, the last phrase says, "The board shall make such reduction of the award granting permanent total disability benefits as the board considers appropriate."
Jack, I know you've done a lot of study on the offset, and I just have a question about the bill as it's originally written, and then one about the amendments that have been proposed in the offset. As I see, what we're talking about in the bill as it's written is not necessarily age 65. The workman could choose to go on retirement from anywhere between 60 and 65.
I thought it was 62 and 65, but that's...
I may be wrong. Anyway, so the workman could elect at varying levels of Social Security between those two. So we're saying that a PTD who starts receiving those benefits either automatically at 65 or upon election earlier is going to... his PTD benefits are going to terminate except for medical care.
Right.
And then an amount equal to the difference between the maximum amount of Social Security he could have received had he not been injured, however that's going to be determined, went on, and the actual amount that he's going to receive. So it's going to be an increment there that he's going to get on top of that from the carrier, I assume, or from...
Yes.
That money will come from the carrier through the Workman's Compensation Board. And then that will be his replacement for PTD benefits. Now, as I understand the AFL's amendment, we're going to conclusively presume that the workman has made a maximum contribution. And it appears to me that means that we're going to assume that he is receiving the greatest Social Security benefits, whether or not the federal government is actually paying him those. And I wonder, is that going to increase or decrease his, if we went with their amendments, is it going to increase or decrease what he's going to be getting as far as total package?
Well, of course, Mr. Wyman, I have not had the opportunity to evaluate.
I just wonder if that had been discussed in your meetings, and apparently it hasn't.
No.
Okay.
The thing that, I would like to make this comment, though, the thing that bothers me is that we all sometimes have a tendency to forget that the fundamental purpose of the workman's compensation program is an income transfer scheme to ensure that the injured worker, while he is capable, while during the period in which he would be normally working, is not going to be destitute.
that the employer for whom he was working when he was injured is going to be responsible to make sure that he doesn't reach that status. And if he is no longer in the job market at retirement age, I see no reason why the workman's comp carrier should pay him retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. This bill provides that he will receive at least as much as he would have received through the Social Security program had he not been injured, and I think that's extremely equitable.
No further questions?
Not, thank you, Jack. Our last witness is George Moore with the WCB.
I'm George Moore, the employer's representative on the Workman's Compensation Board. At the outset, let me say two things. The board endorses the concept for the need for reforms expressed in all three of the bills that you're going to hear as time goes on, 1048, 1049, and 1050. And there are certain factors that relate possibly primarily to one bill, but in our considerations of all three bills, we may have been a little overlapping in the effect that, for instance, the question of the appeals process and the litigiousness of the system is primarily addressed in 1050, but when we examine 1048 and 1049, we try to keep that concept in mind. We have some suggested modifications for the bills, and with respect to 1048, these are our suggestions. Now, when we address a definition or a formula and we use any numbers, we don't feel that we are the parties in interest, and therefore we don't advocate the numbers that we use in here. We advocate the philosophy of what the formula is, and we feel that there are more appropriate people to determine what the proper numbers should be. First, we address the definition of permanent total disability, and we offer the following definition as a suggestion. Permanent total disability means the loss, including pre-existing disability, of the use of function of any scheduled or unscheduled portion of the body, which permanently incapacitates the worker from regularly performing work at any occupation which the worker previously had the physical ability, experience, and training to perform, or could acquire at a wage not less than the minimum wage level established by the federal government for that worker, weighted to take into consideration the size of the worker's family. Another viable alternative would be to legislate a formula providing for a minimum earnings level based on a percentage of the worker's last wage or earning level, similar to the formulas provided in the existing permanent total statutes. If one of the above alternatives is adopted, the need for income reporting sections is eliminated. We attempt to respond to the concern that an injured worker receives benefits while gainfully employed, and that the restriction be on an actuarially measurable basis. That is our real plea as a regulating agency, is if we can set up the yardstick, the administration of the system becomes vastly simplified. On the other hand, we would like to be affirmative in motivating workers to attempt re-entering the job market without fear of losing benefits if the attempt proves unsuccessful. With respect to benefit offset, which is the Social Security offset, we endorse the proposition of benefit offset at retirement age. But we believe that some type of arbitrary offset may be more administratively feasible than filing a sworn statement of annual income. An example might be to reduce the permanent disability benefits at age 62 by 10% biennially, up to a maximum reduction of 50%. This is an approach which has been taken by at least one or more jurisdictions, and I believe Colorado is the origin of this proposal, and seems to be realistic and comparatively simple to administer. This formula would relieve some of the abuses of the present system without penalizing the workers' receipt of benefits from programs such as Social Security, pensions, etc., to which he has made a contribution. Once again, we believe this is a reform which can be actuarially measured. With respect to reexamination of claims, we believe it is just good claims management. The statute now provides for an award adjustment under 645.325. There must be a strong incentive for the insurer to re-examine the permanent total claim periodically, since his share of the benefits paid out decreases percentage-wise under the retroactive reserve payments provided by the board. Perhaps sanctions imposed by the board or the insurance commissioner short of license revocation should be set forth by statute to encourage better claims management. With respect to the income tax information, there is a concern in some quarters that the workman's compensation access to income tax, workman's compensation board's access to income tax information could be unconstitutional, and perhaps a legal opinion should be obtained prior to the passage of legislation. And with respect to Mr. Green's concern about adding the emergency clause, we can certainly see an ease of administration for the carriers if you affect that. That concludes the suggestions, and if you concur with our conceptual considerations, we'll be pleased to assist anybody in drafting appropriate amendments. I'd be glad to.
Mr. Moore, on your definition of permanent total disability is quite different from the one we now have in statute. I noticed that it leaves out the word "and suitable" and substitutes some other criteria.
Yes.
What was the objective behind your draft there for that? Did you consider that you were addressing the odd lot doctrine when you did that?
I believe what we were trying to address was to eliminate the argument and curtail the number of appeals, because every time you deprive anybody or take something away from somebody else, there's always the proposition of the appeals procedure.
So this really addresses the clarity of the statute as far as appeal reasons rather than trying to deal one way or the other with the odd lot.
That's correct. We don't
George, I was interested in what you had to say on the where you said, on the other hand, we'd like to be affirmative, but motivating workers to attempt to re-enter the job market without fear of losing benefits is attempt proves unsuccessful. I met with a group of doctors a week ago last Monday, and they tell me that many of their patients are reluctant to having suffered a back injury, have attempted to find work and can't find a job because of this back injury, that if that second injury fund was adequate, or the employer, if the employer wouldn't, it wouldn't be charged to the employer if this man had a subsequent injury resulting from this, from the first injury, from the first employer, that he could be hired. They tell an example of a young man that is playing tennis, but can't get a job. They won't hire him. Now, can't we do something with that second injury fund, and how much would it take to adequately fund that second injury fund so that an employer doesn't have to be fearful of hiring a man once he's been injured? We just figured out that in a five-year period, if that man would last 5 years on the job, it would save the fund better than $50,000.
Senator, we had a request from
My office.
Senator Thorne, your office, I've forgotten where it came, for a study by the board and a report to the legislature during the session. And as a result of that, we convened a committee who have been looking into that. Their final report to us is due this Friday, and it will be forwarded to you in the within the next few weeks on the subject of second injury fund.
What do we have in the second injury fund now? Is it adequate, or, you know?
Are you talking about the funds now?
The fund itself. What is it? Is it adequately?
The fund right now receives one penny of the 14-cent assessment, one of the workers' pennies. And that is approximately $1.8 million a year. Now, we have sufficient money to carry us through this fiscal year. There is a second penny which has been going to set up the Disability Prevention Center to buy equipment to staff and move the staff and pay the moving costs and so forth. We are going to reassign the proceeds of that penny, which we're allowed to do by statute, and one of the places it can be put is second injury fund. If we elect to put that in second injury fund, we would probably go along for another 2 to 4 years.
Are you funding, why, if this fund, if you have the adequate funds, why is the employer afraid to hire a man that has been injured previously if there's adequate funds in there to compensate this injured workman as a result of the second injury?
This is an opinion, but I think it's because of the administrative difficulty of getting those funds, of applying for, and
is that who you regulate those funds? What is the administrative difficulty of getting funds from you?
Well, they have a responsibility to show that they, in the first place, notice and knowledge at the time of hiring, rehiring, or retaining. Then it has to be shown how the first injury related to the second injury, and a determination of what percentage of the additional costs, which also has to be proved, is attributable to that. So, and it really is a rather complex thing, and this is what we hope we're going to be able to recommend, a simplification of some kind, because we've gotten some statistics that we never had before, which are very meaningful from this report. That's a little advanced.
How soon do you have that, George?
The committee is reporting to us this Friday.
Good.
And I don't know, the board will probably want to take a week or so to digest it.
Perhaps, and then we have a recommendation for us as far as legislation is concerned. If you need additional funds or...
That's correct. We will probably report to the legislature within the next few weeks.
Next few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, thank you, George. We have Gene Hare, we're Secretary of Treasurer, Association of Western Pulp and Sulfite Workers. Gene?
Thank you, Senator. I'd just like to comment briefly on the concept of the Social Security offset and my experience, my exposure of it in the state of Washington. It's a little spooky to get into. There's administrative headaches. On top of that, the Social Security Administration is not the best government agency with which to coordinate with. You know, the Department of Labor and Industry and the self-insurers have had their share of problems. I would hope that if this thing is adopted, that a workman at the time he applies for his Social Security benefits, that he still continues to receive money from his insurer or his employer or from SAFE until he actually receives the money from the federal government, because
their experience has shown us there has been up to 6 months delay in getting money from the federal government. The problem comes is that he does get it, he gets it retroactively, and he gets a lump sum payment. And then there's the problem of recovering that on the part of the employer or the department. So I just, even though there is some gain by getting money in from the federal government instead of having it come from the workman's compensation system, it isn't a freebie and a windfall. There's considerable administrative cost in it.
Gene, as I understand, it was very difficult and had a rough time when they first instigated this program in the state of Washington. However, it is working well now.
They're still having some problems. I talked with Leon Flattery as recently as a month ago, and they're getting some money now, but they're still having a lot of coordination problems.
George, have you heard any problems with the system, the Social Security offset in the state of Washington now? Well, I know they had it was an administrative nightmare at first, but it seems to me that it's worked out quite well at the present time. We can get further information if we.
I think it would be wise for you to look into it.
Okay.
That was the only thing I wanted.
Appreciate it.
Well, that would conclude the hearing. At this time, I'd like to appoint a subcommittee, an ad hoc committee. I'd like to include in that and meet, then we'll, if they can work with staff here, with probably Rich Wyman, who is chairman or chairman administrator for the labor portion of the committee.
I'm sure you're going to give up your job for me.
Not quite. But on that would be Cliff Troll and myself from, and L.B. Day, Bob Kennedy, George Lewis, Carl Frederick, Roy Green, and Jack Kalinowski. And if I would ask the staff to coordinate this, and when we can get together, and as soon as possible, and I think if they can bring their amendments up there, and if the staff could have a marked-up bill at that time, if Connie would have the bill marked up at that time, and let's see what we can accomplish.
That relates to this bill, 1048.
Relates to 1048 only. With that, we are adjourned.